Celine Dion.
Welcome to Full Power Living, the only show on international media that's dedicated to the exploration and understanding of emotions and their role in human life. I'm Eileen Dillon, your creator and host. What if we took a world authority on the teachings and philosophies of a discarnate individual named Seth and sat him down with a neuroscientist and authority on synchronicity and asked them questions concerning the nature of personal reality? Questions like, how does the subconscious mind work, and can we really manifest the lives we want to live continuously? And how do we identify our hidden talents, or a whole host of various questions? Today's show is that show. It's about your own personal reality, and mine, and all of ours. Today we have a special 90-minute mini-summit broadcast for you, so you can participate by asking your own questions with enough time for our guests to respond in depth. So during this broadcast, interact with us on our chat, and I see we already have a number of people on the chat, which is great. Welcome to all of you. That's the chat on blogtalkradio.com/FPL for Full Power Living. We also have a toll-free number, 800-630-7858, 800-630-7858. Or you can, if you're on Blog Talk, you can call the number that's at the top of your page as well. And we also have a chat on emotionalpro.com on the show page. So our two respected guests today talk with a great deal of authority on their topics. For more than 30 years, Paul Helfrich, Ph.D., has been exploring the Seth materials, as well as attending and presenting at Seth conferences since 1996. He was the admin for the SethNet email list from 98 to 2009, and he's a preeminent Seth scholar. Paul also has written essays and lectured and presented workshops about the channeling phenomenon and integral psychology. He's a musician whose 2003 Mindscapes music CD is available on iTunes, Rhapsody, and CD Baby. And he's now employed in the Waldorf schools as a first grade teacher for 26 very fortunate children who can reap the rewards of Paul's deeper knowledge. You can find him at Paul Helfrich, PaulHelfrich.com. Our other guest is Kirby Surprise, PhD, and yes, as he so sweetly supports us, Surprise is his real given name. He has a doctorate in counseling psychology from the Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco, and he worked as a social worker in impoverished areas before returning to graduate school. Right now, he works in an advanced outpatient program for the state of California, which, as we found out in his appearance earlier this year, means that he has the very intriguing and important job of determining whether California prisoners are mentally ill. He's a professional communicator, group educator, and author, and the title of his book, which you can find on Amazon, is Synchronicity. So please note, and we'll be talking about this, that both our guests are working in positions that give them an opportunity to look into the personal realities of a lot of other people. Dr. Kirby Surprise and Dr. Paul Helfrich, welcome to you both. Welcome to Full Power Living.
Thank you, Eileen.
Great. So I want to establish from the very beginning, are either of you familiar with the work of the other, or are you going to be encountering each other's ideas for the first time?
I don't know, Paul. I'm very familiar with the Seth materials. I'm by no means a scholar of them as he is, but much of my work and my own personal path resulted from an accidental finding of the Seth materials when I was in high school, and it influenced my thinking ever since.
Very interesting. Okay, so you don't know him personally, but you are familiar with some of the, with a lot of the Seth teachings. That's great. The more, Paul, that I read materials that you've written, the more I realize I don't know about Seth, even though I started way long ago, too. So what about you? Are you familiar with Dr. Surprise's book on synchronicity, or are you going to be encountering his ideas for the first time?
I will be encountering the depths of his ideas for the first time. His book is on my wish list, and I certainly want to support it. It looks like a wonderful book and a way of looking at reality creation from that perspective, from all the different things that's involved with his book. So, but I am encountering his work for the first time today, and I kind of left it that way rather than do anything preparatory, because I think the spontaneous nature of our conversation today will result in some delightful synchronicities, perhaps, and surprises.
No puns intended. Okay. Well, I would like our show to be more of a free-for-all than we usually have. So I want to encourage you both that if your work intersects with the other person's work or supports it or challenges it, I want to encourage you to step right in and state your point of view. We don't have to stick with my prepared questions, no matter how much genius is in them. And so we can go forward, and I just want to make sure that you're both willing to do that. And I want to focus on four areas: what personal reality is all about, what synchronicity is all about, the role of emotions in synchronicity and our personal reality, and then how can we influence, change, work with our personal reality. Those are the four areas.
Great.
So I want to start with a personal story. 4 years ago, on June 30th, I had the privilege of attending the birth of my granddaughter, Ava, and she had a very rough birth, and she was having difficulty breathing and coming into her own body once she was born, and respiratory therapists actually were called in to revive her. And then they attached several sensors to her chest, her fingers, her toes, and later in a bassinet to recover. I was allowed to be with her, so I talked to her. It's my habit to talk with any newborn child I can get to, because I orient them to the world. I tell them where they are and talk to them about the journey they've just been on. So a nurse was continuously monitoring her heartbeat, her blood oxygen saturation level, her temperature, and her breathing. And I began to think about what emotion she might feel after this horrendous birth experience, where she was in the kind of caught in the birth canal for a long time. And I thought, if I had gone through that, I would feel unsafe. So I began to say things to her like, it was a very difficult landing, but you're now safe. You don't have to keep going through that difficulty. It's over. All you have to do is relax and come into your body and get your breathing flowing smoothly and so forth. And as I said that to her, the nurse, who was continuously monitoring her, looked up and said, whatever you're doing over there, keep it up. Everything just went to normal. So I bring this up because this person was only minutes old on this earth, but apparently already had some level of personal reality, which I was able to address. And also this individual had some say over what she did, even though she was only minutes into this earth. So, using this example, let's talk a little bit about what are we talking about when we're talking about personal reality, and how do we come to it? Who wants to start?
I'll just add something from the Sethian perspective to start, and just to set the groundwork and the foundations. Kirby has mentioned that he's familiar with this, so it should be consonant with his thinking. Namely, from the Seth perspective, consciousness with a capital C is primary and is the causal, primary causal agent of all reality. So that's just a large opening sort of framework to look at, rather than just looking at the material world and the material body of the infant being the primary causal reality creation engine, as it were, for that experience that you're sharing, Eileen. So even though that infant was only minutes born into the physical world and out of its mother's protective womb, it spent 9 months before that physically, so it was already had 9 months of a physical experience. And then when we look at consciousness with a capital C, we get into what we can generally just call the soul realm, which is eternal from the Sethian perspective. And so this young child is coming from the soul realm into the physical world. And of course, you as the adult there have been on the same journey in physical time, of course, preceding her by many years. And so when you were energetically communicating with her and soothing her and nurturing her and healing her with your voice and with your other energetic bodies, they were communicating at different levels with her. And that would be my explanation as to what helped her to return her readings to normal.
I really like that. It's commensurate with the way I understand it. Kirby, do you have anything what do you want to add?
All right. I tend to start from the physical perspective. One of the things that the Seth Materials did for me was teach me that if you're creating your own reality, that you also have to be very careful about what you're telling yourself and what you come to believe, because we're also prone to creating a lot of delusions. So I tend to start with the grounded physical part, and I do know that physiologically, as infants, we're wired to respond to the comforting sounds of adults. I also think that we are quite multidimensional as beings, that everything is consciousness, but that this energy of consciousness, it has different levels of vibration, different levels of density, and that each successive level of consciousness adds new dimensions and levels of freedom to the ones below it. So, to a great extent, separating out physical causes from, you know, higher levels of consciousness doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think that it is all one integrated system of consciousness, and that if we, you know, either try to do a purely physical explanation or a purely metaphysical explanation, we divide consciousnesses in ways that's not actually practical. I think the whole of the system operates together, you know, across all the barriers of what we would consider different planes of existence.
You know, that's almost overwhelming to consider when I listen to you say it that way. I think, gosh, how many things? It's sort of like learning to drive a car, learning to live a life. How many things can you pay attention to all at one time? So, Paul, Seth says that there are four frameworks or spheres of action that are required to support and maintain physical reality creation. And I thought I'd ask you to talk a little bit about those physical frameworks. We particularly operate mainly in framework 1 and 2 as a way of understanding how we human beings interact with our personal reality or set it up.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain that for us?
Sure, and I just want to second what Kirby just said. I completely agree with that we're taking a holistic, integrated approach to this, to the non-physical and physical aspects, and we want to try to keep them present on the table, so to speak, when we're bringing these ideas to bear. Now, Eileen just mentioned Seth's idea of frameworks of consciousness. In the Seth material, there are only mentions of four frameworks, framework 1, 2, 3, and 4. Framework 1 is the physical dimension or framework of consciousness. So that's where the quantum fields are. Anything material, anything physical is framework 1. Framework 2, then, is incipient or intended to become physically manifest, but it is not physically measurable by physical instruments and our five physical senses, but it functions as a vast supercomputer well beyond. That's a metaphor we try to use for that, but in which everything is holistically connected from the quantum level to the biological cellular level to the psychological, animal, and human levels. Is all connected there. Frameworks 3 and 4 are more esoteric and more inward and more refined energetically. They have to do with the soul realm and what Seth calls the mechanics of transition after death experience and so on, and gets further inward in my understanding towards the Godhead, towards the unified whole. And so the four frameworks function that way, but in the Seth material, he introduced framework 2 in a book called The Individual and the Nature of Mass Events, and showed showed it as a way for what is happening invisibly, so to speak, to the physical empirical measurements, as a way to try and explain some of these things, and certainly from a synchronicity perspective and synchronistic events occurring, it is a consonant framework to explain the nature of synchronicities, because everything is instantly available beyond the speed of light, faster than the speed of light, in framework two, and it helps to manifest things physically in the quantum fields in framework one.
Thank you. Well, now I was wondering if there, it sounds like there may not be a conflict, but Dr. Surprise, you say that the brain constructs and edits our reality, and that we humans influence it, but we don't create it. And you talk about the idea that the fact that we have so much power over the nature of our reality sounds almost absurd to orthodox scientific perspective. So I wonder if you talk a little bit about how the brain constructing and editing our reality fits in here.
Sure. And I excuse me, Paul, if I take about 10 minutes on this.
go right ahead.
Okay, so let me describe the situation that everybody listening is in, which is quite remarkable. The room you're in right now, everything you're experiencing, everything you remember, is a hallucination. And that's not to be glib, and it's actually what's happening for us. What's happening is this, as a physical being, you have billions of sensory neurons that are pointed out into the environment. Each one of them is actually a digital computer. Yes, it's biological. It's not one of those psychotic things where people have chips implanted in them. Your biological systems are actually the most advanced form of technology imaginable. Each one of these billions of sensory neurons is a digital computer. It reads the environment in on-off signals and transmits trillions of bits of information a minute to the universe's largest known supercomputer, which is the brain that's in your head. Now, people don't understand, generally. They think that they're seeing the world directly when they're not. You're seeing a data stream. The brain takes these trillions of bits of information. Oh, and by the way, you don't have just five senses. The latest count leaves it at about 30 altogether. That's not counting the ones that Seth talked about, of course, which are non-physical. The brain takes these trillions of bits of information from 30 different types of sensory channels and constructs, in stages of memory in your brain, a representation of the outside reality. You are literally existing in stages of memory, internal memory in the brain. The part of you that you think of as the conscious self in the physical world is about the size of a walnut up on the frontal lobes of the brain. It has no direct connection to the outside world. What it does have is massive neural nets and cabling feeding this representation of the world from areas of memory. So you're literally living in a reality that's constructed by the same types of processes in the brain that constructs dreams, hallucinations. Now, there's actually trillions of bits more information in the environment and patterns than you can possibly be aware of. If you think about ever having seen a picture rendered by an electron microscope, you know that any speck on your desktop can be magnified to reveal worlds of detail and pattern. We only see what we're interested in seeing. You know, our brains evolved to filter out information from the environment. We delete most of what's out there automatically as not important. You know, that's why you don't remember every car and license plate you pass on the way to work. It has no emotional importance, no emotional valence to us. So the first thing the brain does is, based on what you have paid attention to, because the rest of the brain is at your command, it's very much listening to what the conscious mind pays attention to and thinks is important. So it deletes out everything that you haven't cued as important to you in the past. And it highlights and completes patterns in the environment that you've been interested in. For instance, if you buy a new blue Toyota, suddenly there's blue Toyotas all over the road. Now, to some degree, they were always there, and now, simply because you've been paying attention to blue Toyotas, you're seeing all the ones that weren't there to begin with. So there's a lot of editing that goes on. You choose your personal reality and the meanings in it by choosing what's going to become conscious for you. And again, this is still only on the level of your brain being a computer system. You also create patterns around you by filling in things that are blank. For instance, adults, when they read, they don't read complete words. You read the first part of each word, and then from the context of the sentence and what you've been reading, the brain fills in the meaning. So you skip across vast amounts of information, getting the gist of it instead of processing the whole thing. On top of this, however, you do have a direct influence on the environment around you, the actual environment. We're very sure that you change the patterns in the environment by 5 or 6% normally. These are what cause synchronistic events. It's a very direct reflection of your emotions and your mental activity. And it's a full spectrum reflection. It's all levels of your consciousness at once. Because you have some control over what you consciously choose to think, you have some control over what patterns of synchronistic events you produce in the environment around you. But it's very much a reflection. So that what you're getting back is not only your emotions, your thought patterns, but what you believe about the environment. So, for instance, if you have a psychotic belief pattern, the environment will tell you whatever story it is that you've chosen to focus on. This is one of the reasons why synchronicity has been so difficult to unravel. If you're a Jungian and you look for archetypes, the mirror reflects back your thoughts, and you see the patterns of the archetypes that you were thinking about. If you want to see the universe as being created by Bugs Bunny, the universe will talk to you as Bugs Bunny. So you very much are creating your personal reality all the time in realms of meaning and the meaning amongst events on the outside of you. There is a scientific explanation for this now in string theory, which also parallels a lot of the Seth materials. We now understand that we are living in an infinite amount of probable universes, each one on a thin membrane right next to each other, and the distance between them is probably about the size of the smallest possible quantum change. So you're living and passing through and traveling through infinite probabilities right now. Your thoughts, your emotions, your feelings, your beliefs steer you through these probabilities. You exist across many dimensions and many planes at once. A type of reality creation that Seth sometimes speak of that people find the most interesting, the possibility of creating the matter itself, if it's the matter itself, whether a dream or an illusion, is somewhat reflective of the way neurologically we edit the environment. But as physical consciousnesses alone, if you could have separated them out, our primary personal and immediate ability is to create patterns of events in the environment. Every one of us is living in a reality that meaning is determined by what we're looking for, what we're thinking, and what we've already experienced. And as a psychologist, you know, we know that the clients we do therapy with also experience life events that are based on their past experiences, not only their hopes, their dreams, and their spiritual aspirations, but their traumas as well, their social learning, their religious schooling. So, for instance, when you were talking the infant back into their body, that is, you know, something that happens on many levels at once, and that infant will learn from that nurturing experience and reflect that in turn back out into the environment. And I think I'll leave it at that for now.
Great. I think you were just under 10 minutes. That's good. Okay. So as you were talking, I was thinking, one of the principles that I work with in my life and as a therapist is that what you pay attention to, you feed energy to, and you tend to become. And that is what I understood you were talking about. You were laying the groundwork for. So I just wanted to put that in. Paul, do you have a response?
Yeah, I was taking notes, actually. And wonderful discourse there. Of ideas. I just want to add some nuances just from my perspective too. Kirby used the word hallucination, and that has a strong connotation to it that I'd like to nuance from a Sethian perspective. Seth, and from the Eastern philosophies, we get this idea of illusion, of Maya and Samsara as the world of illusion. And what Seth added was this term of idea construction. And I really prefer that term because hallucination has its own pejorative connotation of more of a pathological nature. And so I'm just making a shade of distinction here. Hallucinations, Seth would call secondary constructions of our own from the own body-mind system that I am seeing, such as Bugs Bunny, the universe talking to me as Bugs Bunny, whereas no one else is in my immediate surroundings is creating that as a secondary construction. So the nature of the primary constructions, he makes a distinction there, is something that we share in our collective reality. So that's just something in that area too. The brain as computer analogy is a huge area to get into. I think it has purpose and meaning, but it's also limited in terms of this multidimensional self. And we use the iceberg metaphor that the tip of the iceberg is the physically manifest portion of the five physical senses. And then this vast submerged portion of the iceberg or multidimensional self, of course, is independent of any computer analogy that is limited to the framework one or the tips of the iceberg there. So just, you know, again, nuancing from my own perspective, what Kirby was saying. I also, he used the word attention, which is really critical in terms of personal reality creation, our own attention, how we attend to things and how we do filter things in and out. And Seth uses the term the conscious mind is what's involved with that. And it's not just the waking self, but that involves the dreaming self and gets into what he calls the inner self. And again, this is this larger multidimensional personality that we are. Jane, in one of her poems, used the metaphor of we are the soul in chemical clothing. And I really, that captures a feeling tone of this non-physical self that we are in our truest sense, in our original sense, but yet here we are having a physical experience. And all this wonderful information and science, neuroscience about the brain and everything that Kirby was mentioning is just marvelous and fills into our knowledge in terms of personal reality creation there. And he briefly touched on probable universes, and the Sethian view is that it is a massively parallel multiverse and that we have probable selves. And I'll point out that Jane tried to create her own theory called aspect psychology in her first book, Adventures in Consciousness, if anybody's interested in checking that out. It has a lot of information from Jane in the 1970s, trying to reconcile Seth's ideas with this sense of being having probable selves that split off and can reintegrate with each other. So I'll just stop there.
That is really, really wonderful. Thank you. Oh gosh, you're just I'm regretting that I only set 90 minutes aside. It sounds like we could go for a long time. I think we'll take our first break here. You're listening to our mini summit here on Full Power Living, where I'm talking with Dr. Paul Helfrich, a 30-plus year scholar, researcher, author, and lecturer on the Seth material, channeled through Jane Roberts, and neuropsychologist Dr. Kirby Surprise, who's author of the book Synchronicity and an early Seth reader. I'm Eileen Dillon. You're listening to Full Power Living. We're going to be right back.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
How difficult is it for you to ask directly for what you really want? To take responsibility graciously and willingly for your mistakes? Or to relate with others because it's fun instead of because you need something from them? Most people believe manipulation and codependence are normal behaviors for adults. They may be common, but they're not normal. Manipulative behaviors really are designed to be part of childhood, to be put away as things of the past when we become adults. So, if you're ready to let manipulation and codependence be part of your past, then get the mini course I've created for you, Ending Codependence, The Bottom Line. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, offering you a formula that you can follow for creating healthy, manipulation-free, and lasting intimate relationships. I also give you the tools and principles can use to develop lasting immunity to codependence. Get Ending Codependence today at www.emotionalpro.com. That's emotionalpro.com. Next week on June 28th, I'm interviewing Robert Taylor, a man of the cloth who has worked on many, many of the world's problems, such as homelessness and disease and war, including working closely with Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He has a wonderful new book entitled A New Way to Be Human that we're going to be discussing. You can find out about our upcoming guests at the top of our radio show page or subscribe, and we hope you don't miss a single episode with the amazing guests that we have here. Let me remind you, talk to us right now, 800-630-7858, or on either of our chats at emotionalpro.com or on blogtalkradio.com/FPL. You can download the podcast afterwards from emotionalpro.com, and you can also subscribe to Full Power Living on iTunes. And we are so grateful to you for helping us with our mission of transforming our world through the mastery and power of human emotions. We're talking today with Dr. Kirby Surprise, a psychologist whose personal interest is in synchronistic events, and Paul Helfrich, who's a student and teacher of the Seth materials channeled by Jane Roberts. Now, I have another example that I want to share, because both of you have mentioned beliefs, and one of the most powerful things I ever learned from Seth when I started reading back in the early 70s was about beliefs and how you can actually know what's going on in your own subconscious just by identifying what your beliefs are. So I have a personal story, and then I'd like to talk about beliefs based on that story. And I also think it offers a good example of synchronicity. In the last decade, I've had two experiences of being asked to leave during a family crisis, even though I was pivotal to what was happening. In the first, my stepdaughter had a heart arrhythmia. Her heart would beat 200 times a minute. Because she was modest, she had not been going to the doctor to get the arrhythmia fixed. So I started dating her father and eventually married him. But I found a female doctor for her, and I went to all the appointments with both of them, and we scheduled the surgery. And then on the day of the surgery, her two older sisters, who had not been a part of this process to that point, suddenly showed up at the hospital and told me I had to leave the hospital building because her stepmother was going to come and help her recover, and if I was any place in the building, this would be so upsetting that their sister would be unable to heal. That was a bit shocking. The second time is when my ex-husband's 25-year-old son very tragically was hit by a car while he was training for a race on his bicycle, and he had a severe head injury. Now, my ex-husband contacted my husband, Bob, who is a neurosurgeon, and asked him for a second opinion. So the two of us are going to the hospital. I'm taking food for people. And my own daughter, the daughter that I share with my ex-husband, called to tell me that everyone else in the family would be allowed to participate in the day and see the patient in the hospital room, but that I was to sit in the hallway and would not be allowed in the patient's room. Now, these two events were stunning to me, and they hurt. But by the second one, I was finally getting that I need to look at my beliefs. And what I had learned from Seth was to ask, what would I have to believe in order to have this experience? And when I asked that question, something that I hadn't thought about in 50 years came up. Up until about the age of 3, I lived with my birth mother while my father was overseas during World War II, and when he returned, he was granted custody as a single father of two little girls in 1946, something that was unheard of. He was able to prove that we had been neglected, and I had memories of roaming the neighborhood without clothes and hungry. And the neighbors would take my sister and me in, feed us, put some warm clothes on us, and make us feel really good. And then I remembered there came a point where they said something like, well, you know, you're really not part of this family, so you have to go home now. You have to leave. And that was exactly what was happening in these two experiences. So I decided to change my belief, and for 3 weeks, as often as possible, I spoke aloud, I sang, I chanted this new belief. I am a member of everyone's human family. I'm welcome to stay for as long as I want, until or unless I decide to leave. And 2 days after I stopped this ceaseless repetition, my ex-husband's wife called to tell me that she understood I had been excluded previously, she was sorry about that, and she invited me to come and visit at any time. Who would like to comment on this?
May I?
Sure.
Please.
One of the things I've noticed about synchronistic activity that parallels the Seth material is power of thought. And that, unfortunately, the things that we sort of unconsciously carry with us are reproduced in our environment the same way our conscious desires are. And that any kind of traumatic material, we know that when we watch the brain now, we have fMRIs, we can watch it process. We can actually see experiences being processed into long-term memory from an area called the hippocampus. And it can take many, many years for the brain to sort of fully integrate and put away traumatic experiences. And in the meantime, while the supercomputer is sort of chewing on these complex problems, we're projecting them out into the environment. And, you know, they very much replay around us, whether we're conscious of the original sources or not. You know, I don't pretend to have remembered a tenth of what the Seth materials really said. I did take away, though, some very key things. One was the emphasis that, you know, in reality, everything exists in a state of grace. And that sort of the energy of love ultimately is the base energy that everything starts from. And that profoundly influenced my life. And when I'm dealing with people who are operating from what, you know, I consider more isolative, anxiety, fear-driven reality, I try to remember that and cut down on my own judgments about their actions. I think that when people are acting as if other people are not their family, or as if the universe is divided into, you know, desirable and undesirable aspects, that they are operating out of their own pain and fear. And, you know, as I said, the most powerful thing for the Seth materials was his talking about things being in a state of grace.
Thank you.
And just to second what Kirby's saying, yes, the concept of natural grace is from the best-selling book, The Nature of Personal Reality, and it says that we exist in that state of grace before and after. It cannot be taken away from us. It cannot be mediated by any middlemen or people unless we give up our power to do that. So one of the central elements of that book and the Seth material is empowering the individual. And just to add another thing, the divine love concept in the Seth material, he uses a very technical term called value fulfillment, but that gets into the transcendental love from pure source, that from which we come from and from which we return to at the end of time. So value fulfillment is something that's going on in and around this reality creation all of the time. And back to Eileen's stories too, remember, this is a co-creation. This is a mass event that she was involved in with her family, co-creating together. So other, you know, siblings and family members, children are co-creating with their belief systems as well. And the fact that Eileen concentrated on a certain area of her own intention and emotion and meaning of an outcome that she wanted, that she intended, did open the door energetically, and presumably her husband's ex-wife had some bout of conscience too after making that statement, I don't want that woman here when I come, and played it that way, and it played out, and afterwards somehow something opened in her heart and her mind when she realized that this was a violation of Eileen's space perhaps too, and that opened the door for her to have that realization and then communicate that to Eileen as well. And yet Eileen had to make that change in her energetic field for that opening to occur as well. So this as scaling this up, scaling up individual reality creation into mass events certainly is the stuff of systems theory, and that's only about 40 or 50 years old in our current sciences. So there's a lot of interesting information and work to be done in that area too.
Well, I hadn't thought of it as a mass creation. As a therapist, this is the kind of thing, and Kirby, you probably work with this too, this is the kind of thing that I'm constantly working with, that people, I believe, are creating a lot of the pain in their reality by having beliefs such as I had, that I didn't belong to people's families, and then selectively perceiving, concentrating your attention there, so that I've ended up working with the principle of paying attention to not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become, which is what I did here. But I'd like to talk a little bit more about beliefs, because that was eye-opening for me. We can know our beliefs. I mean, Freud said we can't know our own subconscious mind. Certainly Seth goes the other direction, and you seem to agree with that, Kirby. What about beliefs? What's the role that beliefs play in our the creation of our personal reality and in the, our experience of synchronicity?
Well, let me take two tracks here. The first is a lot of the set materials to me were fascinating because my actual sort of hardcore philosophy is theosophy, sort of middle period Alice Bailey stuff. And it all seems to be very much a different set of language system for what Seth was teaching. And in theosophy, we have a concept called thought forms, which is that the energy of your attention creates these objects in these multi-planal universes that are actually composed of real energy, time, and space, and have extra dimensions, and they're integrated, so that the next set of planes over the astral is actually your emotions, and reflects emotional energy, and above that, the mental planes, this is all, I guess, level two in assessed materials, is mental activity, and probability, and patterns, and that what you think actually embodies forms that change the reality around you, and then ultimately, the physical universe itself, everything here is thought forms made by higher levels of reality, you know, that are capable of influencing the actual physical matter. On the physical plane, beliefs are sort of like programs that are running in the brain, and they determine how you filter your environment. So whether they're psychodynamic, like, you know, the way parental models treated you and taught you to model socially, or whether they're religious systems, they're all data that are running in the brain, in memory. They're ways of processing information, of taking in the vast amounts of data from around you, social, physical data, and finding a useful way to deal with them, to discern patterns, to sort of, you know, move them around in your mind to make the information useful. So, for instance, you know, if someone has a I've often looked at people with fundamentalist belief systems, you know, sort of in amazement. So not to pick on anybody in particular, but, you know, pick your least favorite fundamentalist religious belief system. You know, you can wonder how people can believe that way, how people can become, you know, involved with the idea of God and then strap a bomb on and go blow people up. What happens to people is that they see in the world whatever they're believing reflected back at them. So it's not that these people are not sincere or they're not reasonable, but what they're seeing is a world of their own creation. They see, you know, someone gives them their beliefs, and they look out into the environment, and these beliefs are only thoughts. They are, in effect, thought forms. And they see the world filtered and constructed according to the thought forms they've created. And they mistake the mirror for, you know, consensus. So in some ways, you know, we create a personal reality and we participate in a global reality. And there's much confusion in the world in general about, you know, coming to believe what you think simply because, you know, that's what you're thinking. We do have some ability to create our thought forms that will influence the people around us. But to a large extent, you know, our thoughts direct the brain on how to think about the environment, what to see and what not to see, what incomplete patterns to fill in, and with what information. And I think a lot of what the Seth materials told me was to be very conscious about what you're choosing to think, and what you're choosing to believe, and to think about why you think or believe that. And, you know, because those thoughts, although I don't believe as an incarnate personality, you know, in the physical body, I don't believe I have the ability to rearrange the physical matter, I certainly have seen, and actual scientific evidence shows, that we influence the orders of events around us quite heavily. So that's, you know, not as grand a vision as the Seth materials had. But it is simply a human psychological reality that what we believe, we see a world that reflects what we believe. And if we believe in a dark and dangerous or a rejecting or a loving and graceful universe, that's what we're experiencing. And sort of to change the nature of personal reality requires, in a lot of ways, changing only the way we think about the universe and what we're looking for. Because as a vast multiverse, we can see whatever portion of it that we choose to see.
Thank you.
And I'll just add to that, you know, with my Waldorf experience, Rudolf Steiner is the founder of Waldorf Education. He was a theosophist for many years, and then he had a falling out with Blavatsky and her lieutenants, and formed his own version that he ended up calling Anthroposophy. And this is something I've been studying very closely for the last 3 years as part of my Waldorf training. So I have a very sympathetic connection when I read Blavatsky, her work. It reads like Steiner. So I'm increasingly familiar with those metaphysical ideas and what they call spiritual science. And again, thought forms. Seth does use the term thought forms, and I just want to mention again his idea constructions, and that he does use the term hallucinations. I wasn't trying to intend in my earlier comments that he didn't use them or they were somehow not correct. There are hallucinations from Seth's point of view, and he calls them secondary constructions that are based on these belief systems that we hold in our brain, but also in our psyche that gets into the submerged part of the iceberg self. I also wanted to mention that when we're looking at the belief systems, and the primary book, again, in the Seth material, if you're interested, is The Nature of Personal Reality. It's full of all this information on the nature of belief systems and the power of thought. And one distortion that I have noticed within Seth readers, and as just a generalization, is that there's a belief that has emerged that thoughts somehow are 100% causal. That our thoughts, you know, and therefore the beliefs that are generating the thoughts are 100% causal. But I just have to say, in my own explorations of over 30 years, I cannot identify with pristine precision the 100%. I can get to 99.9, but there's always some missing, bizarrely inexplicable element to reality creation that eludes the perfect scientific or empirical or even holistic integral explanation of reality creation. So I just wanted to mention that too. So we do look at thoughts and the nature of thoughts in terms of reality creation, how they relate to belief systems, and I'll leave it at that for now.
Can I speak to that point for a moment?
Sure.
Sure.
One of the fun things about trying to, you know, we are creators of explanatory fictions. And to me, you know, Erwin Abbott wrote a book called Flatland. And it was about a universe where the beings are only two-dimensional. They're essentially living on a sheet of paper. And there's no up and down to them. And if you, you know, bump into one of them, they have to go around each other because they can't go over or under. And if you were to try to explain three-dimensional reality to them, that there's an up and a down from the plane they're sitting on, they absolutely just would not understand it. And if an object were to pass through their plane, it would seem to appear magically, you know, and then disappear as it passed through. Very much, you know, when we're using physical language and in our bodies here trying to talk about these other planes of consciousness, we're at a disadvantage because each successive plane adds dimensions, you know, and they're as profound an addition as it is to making three-dimensional universes and trying to explain them to two-dimensional beings. While we're physically incarnate, you know, we're trying to understand these spiritual and planes of consciousness, but in fact they possess dimensions, degrees of freedom, and geometrically increased levels of complexity that are not fully possible to understand as a physical being. So that there's always this other factor. There's always this sort of trickster element where things don't line up because we're trying to think about them in physical terms. And in fact, you know, if they have more dimensions than our physical entities can fathom, because our brains are sort of keyed to a physical universe, we wind up seeing these anomalies and being confused by them. My own belief is that it's all technology, that, you know, consciousness is a technology, that everything is degrees of thought forms, but that, you know, we get confused because innately, when we're incarnate, we can't experience all the dimensions involved. And I think that that's not a difficult thing. I think it's a thing to wonder and be joyful about.
Mm-hmm. So let me go to the chat. The question is, I wonder if I'm meeting a probable self in synchronistic events, or is the multiverse speaking to me?
I'll take it that it's a synchronicity question.
Yep.
My view of multiple probabilities is a little different than the Seth materials as I understand them. He's talking about probable selves as sort of discrete personalities living, you know, separated out in chunks, sort of like sub-personalities. What I'm saying is that as multidimensional beings, you yourself are living in an infinite amount of variations in your possible physical universe right now. The same way that, you know, if someone says, oh, you can't travel in time, it's kind of funny because we're all traveling in time. You know, we are proceeding in time at the speed of light, according to relativity. I believe we also travel in probability, that we move through time by moving from one probability to the next, and that we encompass vast amount of these alternatives all at once right now, and that your thoughts, your feelings, and your attention direct you on the courses of these travels, and that there, you know, we don't have an infinite range. Me becoming president during the next election cycle is far-fetched. In other words, a very, very large distance, in probability. But the likelihood I'll take a drink of water in the next 10 minutes is very close in probability. You learn to think in different dimensional terms. Thinking in terms of probability is learning to think in another dimensional space. And, you know, I don't know if there's an alternative me out there somewhere, you know, in a probable, you know, probable alternate. I do know that we do travel in these more sort of tiny but infinitely more parallels. And I believe that our synchronistic events are not generated by the universe speaking to us. I believe they're generated by us traveling in probability until our mental and emotional activity matches the probability that we're in. I think that anything is possible. I tend to try to keep it down to the smallest kind of, you know, verifiable change. So I think that we travel in probability, that we are vast beings. And I think that in terms of sort of a Zen Buddhist perspective, I think that there is no separate entities. I don't believe that we're separate from the environment. I think it's one field of consciousness. I think that field of consciousness is immensely complex, very multidimensional. But I don't believe in this idea of separation. In my studies of shamanism, if you sort of learn to climb the astral plane, you find out that on the bottom levels, things look like discrete entities, spirits, things coming and going out of incarnational cycle, sort of natural denizens of the spiritual world. But then as you climb the levels of consciousness, you know, those distinctions disappear. You realize that things that looked like entities are actually your thoughts. People you assumed were separate from you turn out to be parts of the same incarnational consciousness, you know, split off into different aspects for different plays. And that eventually distinctions of self and other and self and environment or self and, you know, other levels of consciousness just eventually disappear. You know, we're left with, you know, being one entity. and as one entity, you know, it's, there's no longer that sort of question about, are you influencing the environment or is it influencing you?
Thank you. Okay, Paul?
Just to add a little bit to that, from the Sethian perspective, right, as Kirby's implying, at any given moment in our personal reality creation, we're dealing with infinite potentiality. There are more and less probable events in our immediate pool of probabilities that are around us, like taking a drink of water in the next few minutes or getting elected to be president of the United States. But given the nature of our consciousness trying to spontaneously create newness, creativity in itself, in its pure self, that's where these probable selves and probable realities and massively parallel universe explanations come into play. And it gets big and it can be very intellectual and confusing too. And so I just want to offer one practical solution that I've seen some folks in the Seth community do with probable selves, and that is to use it as a tool to solve problems and to say, for example, someone posted on the SethNet email list years ago that they were driving their truck and the wheel, something went wrong with the right or the back wheel somewhere in the car, the truck broke down, and he was back there and he looked at it and he had no idea how to fix it. And so he simply shifted his awareness to say, okay, I know there's a probable me, and not just a probable out there someone else, but probably if his name was John, let's say, he said, there's a probable John right now that knows how to fix this thing. So let me just take a minute, relax my attention here from not knowing into knowing. And he came up with the solution. As he started to look, suddenly it became apparent what he needed to do to fix that wheel and get his truck going. Now, whether that explanation, you know, holds up to scientific inquiry, of course, we'll leave that out there as well. But it seems that with these metaphysical explorations we have, we need to bring them back to practical applications as often as possible. And there are. So I'm just offering that in that context.
Wow. Yeah, I was thinking as you both were talking about, you know, I often think, as say I'm driving down the street, I see people working really hard to build a building or do something in the physical world, and I realize how much of our attention we focus on the physical world and the things we do there and so forth, and at the same time, I realize that in the scheme of things, it may not matter, sort of like a Zen sand garden. And so that's really interesting to me. It's like we're here in the world, and our personal reality matters, and also we're part of something so much larger, and our personal reality may not matter at all. So I think we need to take a second break now. You are attending a mini-summit with Dr. Paul Helfrich, who's a Seth scholar, and neuropsychologist Dr. Kirby Surprise, who's author of a book entitled Synchronicity. And we're going to be talking about some powerful ways for you to choose your own personal reality in our final segment of today's Full Power Living coming up next. You're listening to Full Power Living.
Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Do you know that emotionally, children form the foundation for their life during their first 7 years? Most adults just repeat that early emotional learning, good or bad, over and over for the rest of their lives. If you want to give your child an opportunity to live an emotionally masterful life, then join me, Eileen Dillon, also known as the Emotional Pro, for a free one-hour teleseminar on what it takes for your child to become an emotional master. You'll discover important things like what emotions are designed to do for us. Four things it's vital for parents to tell their children about emotions, and the single most important thing to do when someone is feeling emotion. Register now at RaiseIncredibleKids.com. The time has come for us to allow emotions their rightful place in our lives. as the tools and helpers they're created to be. Find out what you need to know in order to give this vital information to your children so they can live emotionally masterful lives. Go now to RaiseIncredibleKids.com for your free Emotional Mastery Teleseminar. Living, discussing our personal reality, synchronicity, and the effects of emotions on our personal reality with Dr. Paul Helfrich and Dr. Kirby Surprise. We have a couple of things on the chat, so I want to get to those first. From Lori, we have, "Hi, Eileen and Paul, I've read the Seth books first in 1980, and one question always remains. Does my inner self see my physical reality the way my eyes see it, or only feel or sense it?"
Well, that's a big question, but I always sort of say yes and no to that, because, you know, as Kirby has indicated, we, in our explanations and the maps that we use to try and explain these non-physical portions of the submerged iceberg self, you know, we tend to separate things, so we use separate words and we create separation where there is none. So you are, the one answer is that you are your inner self looking out the soul in chemical clothing, so your inner self is seeing exactly what you're seeing. And yet we know that there is a distinction being made ontologically, or in the nature of our multidimensional being, that says what we are here in our waking state is somewhat different from the soul or entity's natural state or focus of attention. So there's a yes, and there's a, and when I get into that, I get into paradox, and I think when we get into paradoxical explanations from a rational standpoint, that's a good thing, because we're starting to hint at these unknown, non-linear or non-physical, what Seth calls the unknown reality, and aspects of it that we're trying to grasp intellectually, that of course we can never fully grasp with the intellect alone, so we need our intuitions and feelings and emotions to really help understand that. So yes and no.
Okay, good explanation. All right. So another one, I believe we humans have a vast untapped creative potential sourced in what Paul named as Seth's Framework 2, and I'm wondering if you would agree that synchronicity indicates opportunities to tap this larger realm to manifest more of what we want in our everyday world, including personal things, all the way to collective manifestations like world peace.
Yes.
Synchronicity questions, though. Can I have that one?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I believe that, you know, the capacity to create synchronistic events is something that we actually evolved as physical creatures. That, you know, we used to be grassland hunters. And that, you know, this maybe 3-6% ability we have to change events in the environment was a survival tool. And what it shows us is that if we, you know, our brains haven't changed in 50,000 years. We're still essentially the same creatures. And this ability was designed for us to get what we want. You know, the hunter goes out and looks for the patterns that indicate where the game is. So as hunters, you know, we weren't as intellectually active and didn't have kind of the mental luxuries that we do nowadays. The hunters was very much about survival and looking for what you need. Synchronicity is a very direct mirror. You know, if you're looking for what you have actually decided you want, the pattern of that and the opportunity to get that or manifest that occurs in the environment more often. Unfortunately, you know, we're still, as a society at large, it's just sort of coming out of a Freudian sort of era where people believe that therapy mostly entails looking backwards at what it was that traumatized you, or looking at what's preventing you from manifesting what you want. That's sort of a deadly and counterproductive attitude in some ways. You know, if you, say for instance, go to a workshop based on, you know, finding out what's preventing you from manifesting loving relationships in your life, synchronistically, you know, well, there may be use for that, synchronistically, what you're doing is you're focused on what's preventing you from doing something, which manifests as a direct mirror as events in the environment that prevent you from doing something. Very much when you take responsibility for what you're thinking, you realize that, you know, you creatively go forth in the world and create the pattern you actually want. To think about what it is that you want to see happen around you. And this speaks to sort of Seth's thing about attention, is that, you know, your will, your free will is to direct your attention and to use the results of that attention, the manifestations of that attention, to get what you want, not to focus on what you don't want. As far as the collective aspect of it, my experience has been that these other dimensions don't have the same limitations that physical reality does. In physical reality, you think that if five people are working on building something, that it goes quicker than one person building it, because it's a collective effort. Well, these other levels of consciousness, these kind of limitations don't exist. You know, the question of, you know, are wills working across purposes isn't relative anymore. It's more collective. You and everyone around you can choose your own pathways without interfering with each other. It's a degree of freedom that we're not accustomed to thinking to when we think of an ordinary linear cause and effect. So I would say that, you know, you manifest what you're thinking about, and your thoughts do not interfere in other people's. And these other levels of consciousness are very much tied up in meaning, in emotion, you know, and in things that are sort of intangible and psychological to us. So that, you know, your feelings, your experiences of meaning in the world are going to be different than the person sitting next to you. But they're not going to interfere with the person next to you. And their view of reality doesn't have to interfere in yours either. You're each living across a span of probabilities, not just a single reality.
All right. Thank you. And we have another question. I would also like to, this is from Alice, is wondering, I would also like to know if Paul has read the book called Bridging Science and Spirit, Common Elements in David Bohm's Physics, The Perennial Philosophy in Seth, and if so, what are your thoughts?
Yes, I have, Alice, and I was introduced to that in the mid-90s. It's a wonderful book by Norman Friedman, who was involved with SethNet International. And actually, that was where I was introduced to the work of Ken Wilber and the notion of the perennial philosophy in that book. The section on the perennial wisdom in that book is very small. And Norm said to me years later, after I met him, he passed away in the early 2000s, that he wished he had made that a bit bigger and some of the quantum theory a little less dense in that book. But Bridging Science and Spirit is reflective of what was going on, I think, in general in terms of consciousness studies at that time in various fields and various parts of the academy and outside of the academy as well during that time. So it's and he uses that to show then the connections of the Seth material to quantum physics, specifically Seth's notion of consciousness units and electromagnetic energy units, which we just abbreviate as CUs or EEs. And they stack up nicely. I use a structure called CU/EE/QF for quantum field to try and look at, from a particulate, sort of the minimal building block of reality creation at the smallest level from the Sethian perspective, to include those ideas of his consciousness units. Electromagnetic energy units are predisposed towards physical constructions. And so that's and in that book is where Norm tries to unify and explain that. So it's a great book. Anyone interested should look that up and get it.
Great. Thank you very much. Now, Kirby, in your book you state that if there is an energy that drives synchronistic events into action, it's the energy of our emotions. And you quote some research by Dr. R.B. Rhine at Duke University, which concludes that synchronistic events follow the patterns of the emotions and beliefs of those who observe them. So I'd like to talk a little bit here about emotions. Emotions are connected to what? Come up because of what? Start at because of our thoughts, or are there and get organized by the kinds of thoughts that we have? And Kirby, let me start with you on this one.
Okay. my view, which is partially unsupportable, the physical part is the brain is wired for four basic emotions. You know, we can watch the brain process, so we know that we have wiring for love, for anger, for revulsion, you know, and fear. And most of our physical emotions are complex combinations of those in different intensities coupled with basic physical drives. That said, I also believe that the next set of planes immediately next to us, the next set of frequencies, what Theosophists would call the astral plane or the emotional plane, is a place where there is, you know, more dimensions in the physical, but the actual energy of the place, the matter and sort of electromagnetic energy of it, is emotion. So this sort of bridges the gap between, you know, personal experience and physical reality, saying that there are these other planes are very much like the physical in that, you know, they are energy and they are mass, but they're a different kind, and that that energy has a different degree of freedom. I like to use the analogy as a physical being that our brains are sort of like radio telescopes. Radio telescopes receive signals from space, and then they run them through a computer system. And the computer has a bunch of programming in it that is designed to resolve those vibrations into physical images. That's how we get these beautiful color pictures out of what essentially is radio signals. And I think that, you know, what we experience of other planes of consciousness depends on what's loaded in the computer, our life experience. Now, the computer is predisposed to think of the universe in the four basic neurologically based emotions, but it's also based to interpret symbols based on personal life experience. So that, you know, if there's an extraplanal energy or experience influencing five different people, each one of them is going to experience that in terms of what's in storage in their supercomputer, in the brain. It's sort of like light shining through different stained glass windows. You know, it depends on how you've painted your window. The patterns on the window are usually determined by, you know, your temperament, which is partially genetic, and your life experience. For instance, I've got some experience doing shamanic work. And, you know, I've seen circles in which, you know, everybody reports seeing an entity appear. So some people say it looked spider-like. Some people will say it was ant-like. Some people will say it was like a grasshopper or a praying mantis. They each report subtle details that are different. But overall descriptions say is somewhat insect-like. So what's happening is whatever is out there non-physically is being interpreted through the computer of each individual with a radio telescope. So, you know, and I think that's the reason why we get a lot of disparate views on how emotions work. You know, I think that we interpret it according to our experience, but there probably is actual physical emotional energy out there.
Well, that's my experience, and I like to help people with it. Thank you.
And just to add the Sethian perspective just succinctly, that Seth says that all emotions are the results of beliefs and thought processes. So, and so there's a twofold way of doing the work then, therapeutic work, introspective work, that you can see what emotional storms are arising in you and then trace it backwards, do a retrograde review of what was I just thinking about, what just happened, and I've learned to do this and trace it back to, why do I have this knot in my stomach? My day was going fine just well. What's it? Oh, right, I have to call this person because this situation is going on. And as soon as I identify that, the emotion settles down and I go on and do that. And the beliefs that are involved with that, of course, are part of the introspective work that we learn to do with belief work. So belief work is something really central, and again, that's in this classic bestseller, The Nature of Personal Reality. And I just wanted to throw in another idea in general to our conversation today, too, that we've been mostly talking about reality creation in the waking state. And we just need to point out, of course, that there's a dreaming state, and a deep dreamless state, which is known in theosophy and anthroposophy as well. And so the dreaming self and working with dreams is really critical in therapeutic terms and just personal growth and transformational terms. This is a major takeaway from the Seth material and a major focus of various books and sessions and so on in the Seth material. So there's a lot of work that can be done there, and we start to identify belief systems within our dreaming self, and this ties into the depth psychology lineages, Jung and Freud and others that have their psychotherapies based on that, identifying, working with dreams, and then you're working with the belief systems that are connected to those images and whatnot, and the intensities of those, and coming out of that then are the emotional states, which are in waking state, but also in dream state. We have emotional states, and as Kirby was mentioning, from the theosophical and anthroposophical view, the astral body is the creation engine in those systems of thought of the emotions that come out of us. But of course, our brain is a major filter, and Kirby knows this, and Eileen, probably you too, much better than I do in terms of what portions of the brain, the limbic system and so on, or the fight and flight areas of the brain involved with emotional traumas and pathology and big events in our lives that we have to deal with. So, but I just wanted to mention the states, the importance of looking at states and dreams as well.
Okay, and Paul, while you're talking, I mentioned at the top of the show that you have this past year been teaching first graders in the Waldorf School, and the question that came to me this morning is, what have you learned about the formation of personal reality from these small beings or people in small bodies that you've been working with in the past year? Have you learned anything different or new or observed anything?
I've been filling in the blank, I've been connecting the dots, filling in the blanks in my understanding from studying developmental psychology with Ken Wilber and Don Beck, his spiral dynamics and whatnot, which looks at the adult spectrum of development. But within the Waldorf framework, what's part of Steiner's genius was that he understood stages of development and took it from in utero to infancy through seven, which is the first change of teeth, the second dentition, and then from 7 to 14 or thereabouts, which is the onset of puberty, and from 14 to 21. And there's 7-year cycles in his anthroposophical view of development. So this is what we are trained with, to look at with the children. And we also look at, it's a theosophical, anthroposophical view of the etheric bodies, the etheric forces in the cosmos, the astral forces in the cosmos with the children as well. And what's so beautiful is that it helps to inform the pedagogy that we bring. So what we do in classes with the children to help them learn to become, the outcome of Waldorf education is to create fully integrated, free-functioning human beings. And unfortunately, that is not the outcome and goal of public schools and even the charter school movement in my view, which I've only studied peripherally, of course. So back to the children, Steiner also intuited what we call in developmental studies multiple intelligences. So he knew that during the course of a day and a week and a month with the children, we want to look at their linguistic intelligence, language, their mathematical intelligence, of course, their social intelligences, interpersonal, intrapersonal, their moral intelligence. This is huge in Waldorf education, touching on the innate moral intuition that we all have, even all through the different stages of development. And of course, we have kinesthetic intelligence, movement. There's a lot of movement activities in Waldorf education. And then the arts, painting, singing, musical intelligence, and so on. Together, creating this tapestry and touching on them pedagogically, what we do with the children, over time, it helps them at this age of 7, where it's important that their image-forming capacities are developed. And that's an amazing thing. So a lot of what we do, just with the painting, with the music, with the storytelling, we don't use textbooks in first through eighth grade. They make their own textbooks through the main lesson work that we do, and over the years they accumulate their own interpretations, drawings, and writings in their main lesson book that becomes their own textbook that's formed in their own images and their own symbols and color palettes and understanding of that. And of course all of the songs and the stories that we tell, fairy tales, fables in the early grades, have pedagogical and moral implications as well. So it's just a wonderful environment where all of this science, art, and spirit come together in a marvelous way every day with the children.
Mm-hmm. And let me just note that I saw some beautiful paintings on your website, paulhelfrich.com, if somebody wants to check that out. And Kirby, thank you, Paul. Kirby, let me go to you because you have a very intense and yet responsible and potentially incredibly difficult job, which is to work with people who are incarcerated and determine whether they're mentally ill. And I assume from that the state decides what they're going to do in terms of caring for them or dealing with them. And so I'm interested in what influence on your understanding of the development of personal reality working with this population has done for you.
Overwhelmingly, what I've found is that raising a loving, functional human being is a huge task that takes a lot of resources and a lot of conscious attention. What my job entails, reading basically someone's entire life history and their records, interviewing them, and then assessing and diagnosing and assigning levels of care for them. So I sort of read the novels of people's lives for a living. And what I find is that, you know, most of the people who wind up in prison with these various mental illnesses are there because the time, love, and resources were not put into them. That, you know, people develop according to what's available to them. People are very adaptive. You know, people create their own reality. And if they grow up in a reality of scarce resources, savage competition, violence, and anxiety, they learn to survive well and become a person that functions well in those kinds of environments. We know when we do statistical analysis of the various factors that lead someone coming into prison, we look at how many parents in the family, the kind of support system, is there alcohol involved? Were they terrified in the neighborhood going to school? What are the resources that a person had available to them? We find overwhelmingly it's very easy to predict who's going to jail and who's becoming mentally ill. That, you know, care, love, and attention needs to be put into people to get a functional, caring, and loving human being from them. The Waldorf schools are an astonishingly good example of what should be done for people growing up. How to teach them to have their own resources, how to guide them into social behavior and creativity. Almost universally, the people I run into in prison, especially those in the mental health system, had the exact opposite. You know, they came into the world with the oldest potential, and then the resources were not put into them. They were shown a world that was brutal, self-interested, dangerous, in which they had to learn to become self-interested predators. And that's what they were taught, and that's sort of what they become. So it's quite the opposite end of the spectrum. I also see quite clearly in the psychotic patients that I deal with, which are actually the majority of the guys that I diagnose, that the physical causes of mental illness predominate. That, you know, in the vast majority of cases, people's illnesses are physically based. You know, the brain is malfunctioned in some ways. They've damaged their nervous system with drugs. They've done all these things that aggravate, you know, whatever talents or predispositions they had to begin with. And, you know, it's sort of easy to look at people who have turned out to be sort of predatory and dysfunctional and sort of blame them. But the reality is that these individuals exist in the same state of grace that we do. And again, the most profound thing I took away from the Seth materials was a sense of not judging people. You know, of not judging them because of the way their circumstances had them turn out. know, they too exist in the sense of grace, and that they too are part of this unified field of consciousness that we all experience. I just think that the children, for whatever reason, you know, that have had the vast privilege of having, you know, people like Dr. Helfer teach them in like a Waldorf school, have such an advantage. And I only wish that, you know, as adults, that we offered like true rehabilitation to people, where, you know, we did for them the kinds of things that Dr. Helfrich is doing for the children that are in his charge.
That's beautifully stated. I'm aware now, I didn't come up in such a mean world as what you just described, but one of the reasons I'm very excited about sharing what I've learned and been able to do over my lifetime, now that I'm 69, is that that I did have a very inhospitable world when I started, and have been able to get past it. And that's another whole fascinating topic, I think, is what capacity we have to get past it, and how, you know, I've lectured at the San Quentin Penitentiary, and I was very impressed. One of the things that impressed me is there's some years around 12 or 14 where people miss out on their development or their love or whatever, and it seems virtually uncorrectable. At least that was my observation. So that's very interesting. Now, Can Do It for Peace, who's on the chat, says, I want Paul to speak about synchronicity from frame two. So I want to be sure to get that in.
Well, actually, you know, Kirby's done a wonderful job, and it's really taking his specifics and applying them to Seth's definition of framework two. I think it's really brilliant what his work is doing, and actually extrapolates, explicates Seth's ideas even further from a very nice scientific point of view. So I really can't add any more except to say, you know, in terms of the synchronistic event, framework two, all of these events in framework two exist in an energetic state that are faster than the speed of light. And as intensities of thought, belief, emotion, expectation, and so on build, they attract and repulse through sympathy, antipathy, energetic attractions and repulsions, different forces, and he calls them threads of consciousness, strands of consciousness, he calls them, and as enough gather to a tipping point, then an event will manifest. And synchronicity is really nature's way of reminding us to pay attention in a very general way, in my view. And I have been so attuned to this over the last 15 years in particular, that when something in conventional beliefs, someone would say, oh, that's odd, that's weird, that's strange, I just smile to myself, because it's a reminder from the larger non-physical me that's reminding me of something of important imagery, something I need to pay attention to, something that I'm focusing on trying to manifest and deal with. So
Brings a smile to my face as I hear you talk about it. That's really great.
Can I add something to that?
Sure.
Okay, The questions that many of these inquiries revolve around are how time works. And, you know, when the Seth Materials came out, he proposed that everything, this is somewhat Buddhist, that there's a single moment of eternal now from which everything acts. String theory, which is what, you know, my models are predicated on now, has come around to that exact model of thinking.
Kirby, let me interrupt you a minute. Our show's going to drop in 1 minute, so you've got to make it really fast.
Seth was right. Everything operates from an eternal moment in the present.
I'm sorry about that. You know, it's just been wonderful. This program has surpassed my dreams and created a really wonderful personal reality for me. And I hope for our listeners, too. We've had a lot of you on today. Thank you so much, Paul Helfrich, who is at paulhelfrich.com, and Dr. Kirby Surprise, who has a book called Synchronicity. Thank you for being on Full Power Living today. I've really enjoyed having you. Thank you for accepting my invitation. Remember to listen to us next week on Thursday, and thank you, Paul Johnston, our producer. Pay attention to what you want to become and not to what you want to overcome.